This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 320. It's unbelievable. So, anyways, I am not coming in tomorrow. Unless something bad goes wrong, but I don't think. I mean, I'm hoping nothing will. Everything's been pretty stable here lately. We've just been puttering along, and it is the first part of the month. So, you know, in the first part of the month, we're not so much worried about things. Things start getting exciting at about the 20th of the month, because that's when my major client does their big recurring credit card push, and the data just piles up. But normally it all goes through fine and everything's fine and it's fine. Normally it's just fine. So far so good with that. I keep advising that sooner or later, you know, we're going to get to a point where things are going to take longer to run and yada, 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 yada. But so far, so good. We have had some beautiful weather here this week. It's really just been gorgeous. You know, it has been a little cool, but man, you know, for this time of year, with what's coming, I will take a little coolness. That is just fine. I've been puttering along with the writing. I'm to that point that I get with books where, you know, I'm not sure we're going in the right direction. I don't know. It's like, oh, where are we going? Where are we going? But this week, I think I've got where I'm headed for the epilogue, which is always a big part of writing these books, of hitting that epilogue, and I think I know where I'm going for this one. I thought I knew where I was going, but I have since switched perspectives. I'm going to drop over to another character and tell it from their viewpoint, and I think it'll make it just stronger all the way around. So, yeah, good. It's good. Beta readers are supposed to be getting back to me with input. This week, I still haven't heard from a ton of beta readers, but we'll see. This was a big, big book, so we'll see. I've heard from several, and I've heard from several more saying they're getting ready me to send me input, so I'm hoping that that's all just going to come in. We'll be good, and then on Sunday, I'll go ahead and start editing Windfall Broadcast. And by that time, I hope to have about 75,000 words down on Windfall, The Narrow Door. It's interesting because that parable, I've just found a couple of different places that I can sort of relate to it on The Narrow Door book. And so that's fun, where I can work those things in. But if I get to 75,000, which I should, I'm already at 73,000 and I've got 2 days this weekend, so shouldn't be any problem getting to 75,000. I'll only have about 50,000 more words to go, which should be at my present write rate, especially if I can stay at 7,500 words a week. 50,000 words should be, what, about 7 weeks worth? And that would be really good, because that would put me ahead, give me more time to edit, more time to do the cover, yada, yada, yada. And whereas I had tentatively planned to have this one to beta about October 15th, I could actually probably get it to beta October 1st, give my people 2 full months before December hits, and then I could get started on the next one, and then December could hit, and I could get it edited up, get the cover finished up. Don't know that I'd have stuff in for Christmas, but it would be really close. So that would be good. That would be good. We'll see if that all works out. What else? This week, the way everything fell, did I have breakfast with anybody this week? I don't think I got together with one person this week, which maybe that's why this has been a weird week. I haven't had a chance to talk to my buddies. I gotta find some people to start going to breakfast with, like on Tuesdays or something. Or on the second Tuesday of the month or something, or the second Thursday of the month. We gotta get something going here. Next week, I'll have at least one friend to pick up, and then the week after that, two or three. So we get back in the saddle. Because when I don't get a chance to talk to my friends, it's, you know, my week isn't as good. It's just not as good. I don't think there's anything else going along. I think we finally made it through all of the graduations and all that stuff. We had a big cleanup day at the church last Saturday. And since my son-in-law is the pastor there, you know, feel a little obligation to go ahead and help out with that. So I was there. I was quite pleased when it was all said and done, because while my back was a little sore, the next day I got up and did some exercising and I was fine. And so I think this whole YRG thing, this yoga stuff, is helping. My back is stronger, which is good. That is very good, because I was pretty much tired of that business of every time I'd lift something heavy, then the next day I'd bend over or something, and bam, you know, I'd be down on my back for a couple of days taking Advils like crazy trying to get my back to relax. So it's good. I do the YRG yoga stuff now about 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and then I also hop on the Nordic track in the mornings and do that 7 days a week, and then on the weekends I do the Nordic track in the evening. So I'm usually exercising around an hour every day, just trying to stay limber and trying to strengthen up a little bit, just not because I'm worried about being any kind of a ripped manly man, because I'll never be one of those. Although, if some of the supplements are to be believed, all you gotta take is those supplements and suddenly you are. I doubt that's actually true. So, since I'm not really concerned about being a manly man, you know, I'm really just looking to preserve my mobility. Because I'm 56, gonna be 57 this year. And I'm really hoping that when I get into my 60s, I'll be able to preserve my mobility. You know, the yogis and stuff in India, they're mobile for a long time. And I'm just hoping that that's going to be true for me as well. And I'm at least going to make the old college try at it. So we will see. This week, I came across a TED Talk that I could have sworn I've talked about before. And even as I was preparing my notes, I thought, man, this sounds familiar. Did I talk about this already? And I went and I hunted through, just using the search function. I hunted through on the search function trying to find where I had referred to this before, and I couldn't find it, but I could have sworn that I've actually talked about this on a podcast. Maybe it was just in passing. But it's an interesting thing, and it really has to do with, how do we know that someone is mentally ill? What really, at the end of the day, what is mental illness? How do we describe it And how do we judge someone as mentally ill and judge that accurately? Because the Scientologist, I forgot to turn down the volume on my phone, so I'm going to do that real quick. The Scientologist would be very happy to tell you that, in fact, all this psychology and psychiatry stuff is just a big crock. That there's no, it's pseudoscience. That what people are, what they're doing is just diagnosing kind of normal weirdness in people and turning it into an illness when they really can't be that definitive on it. It's not like you can just check the blood chemicals and see, aha, you know, like you can for that you had a heart attack or that you've got a blood-borne disease or something like that, that it's really too vague and that it's really too self-fulfilling, that you decide that someone has something and then basically you just pack in the evidence around it. And there is a journalist, his name is John Ronson, and I've seen some other TED Talks by him. And he had written a book called The Psychopath Test. And it was about his research and his reflections on this test that had been developed. And there are actually courses you can take to learn to become a trained psychopath spotter. So you can take these courses because apparently psychopaths are so dangerous that it's good if we have psychopath spotters around. Take these courses to become trained and honed in the skill of figuring out who is a danger around you. And in the process of researching this book, John Ronson was saying what got this started was that he was over at a friend's house and his friend had a copy of the DSM. And the DSM is a manual of mental disorders. He said it used to be a pamphlet when it started out, and now it is 886 pages long, and it has over 374 categorized mental disorders. And he said, as I looked through it, he said, I found that I actually had 14. And he says, you know, in looking through this, maybe the psychiatric profession wants to label normal human behavior as abnormal. And he said, so to pursue that idea, he had gone to lunch with some Scientologists who will tell you that this is all just a crock. And he asked them, so do you have any proof of what you are saying? And they said, yes, we want to introduce you to Tony. He's in Broadmoor Hospital, which is a place where they lock people up who are criminally insane. They're seriously insane, a danger to society. And so they said, you need to go talk to Tony. So they take him in there to talk to Tony. And it turns out this Tony is someone who many years before had gotten into an altercation, beat someone up, was put in a holding cell, and he got talking with the guy in the holding cell. And it was a serious enough beating, apparently, that he knew he was going to jail. And knew he was probably going to serve about 5 years. And so this guy told him, oh man, he said, look, he said, all you have to do is fake being insane. And if you can just fake being insane, they're just going to lock you up in some minimum security place and you're going to have whatever you want to eat. And you just got to go along for a little while and then, you know, you're done. You can get out. So he decided, okay, I'm going to fake being insane. And so he went in. He said, I'd like to see the psychologist. And so they sent him in, psychologist. Or prison psychiatrist. He said, I had just seen the movie Crashed. Crash. And it was about people who get aroused sexually and when they have automobile accidents. And so he said, I decided that I would tell the psychologist that, well, yeah, I like to crash my car into things because it arouses me sexually. And then he said, I also told him that I enjoyed watching women die because that made me feel more normal. Or no, I think I would enjoy watching women die because I think that would make me feel more normal. And he said he got that from a biography of Ted Bundy, that Ted Bundy said that. So we got these two pieces of information, and of course the alarm bells went off. And the psychiatrist kind of went overboard and decided, maybe not overboard, but he made a decision that Tony needed to be in like a really high security insane asylum for criminally insane people. And so he was committed to Broadmoor. Well, as soon as he got there, and he saw the bars on the window, and he saw what his cellmates were like, and all that kind of stuff, you know, he went and he said, look, I was just faking it. He said, this is not where I'm supposed to be. I was just faking it. I just told you those things so that I wouldn't have to go to jail. At which point, they then decided that since he had used cunning in that way, that obviously he was a psychopath. So on the basis that they suspected he was a psychopath, they decided they would keep him. And they kept him for like 12 years. Oh, so the moral of this story is don't lie to psychiatrists. And it's interesting because the reporter said when he met Tony for the first time, he said, most of the rest of the people in the hospital, they've got sweatpants on, they're overweight, they're kind of out of it because they're all drugged up. He said, when he met Tony, Tony came towards him. He said he's wearing a pinstripe suit, he's not overweight, he exercised, he's not all drugged up, he stretches out his hand to shake my hand. And the reporter said he was acting, or he looked very much like someone who wanted to wear an outfit to convince people that he was sane. And this is where we start getting into the gray area. Because once we've decided that someone is insane, criminally insane, a psychopath, how do we undecide that based on the model that we have? Based on the mechanisms that we have. He said, I've tried all sorts of things. My neighbor's out here mowing, so I gotta roll down my window and wave as I go by. Oh, he didn't see me. I'm still waving. He's not like it. Wow, it's a beautiful day today. Beautiful breeze. My neighbor has a huge lawn. Anyways, so he said, I've tried all sorts of things to try to convince people that I am not insane. He said, I tried to read up on stuff. And he said, I actually read an article about how the army was training bees to be able to sniff out bombs. And he said, I'm trying to make pleasant conversation, and my nurse comes in, and I mention this article, and I find out later that she has written in my medical file a note that says, believes bees can sniff out bombs. Because, of course, he's insane. So, if somebody would say something like that, that's just more proof they're insane. And he said, in this hospital, they are always looking for clues to my mental state. And he posed the question, how do you sit like a sane person? I don't know. I don't know that. He said, I have on either side of me in my room, he said on one side, the room next to me, my cell, he said, there's a rapist, and on the other side, there's a strangler. And he said, I'm afraid of them. I'm backing into my garage. He said, so I don't have much contact with them, and I basically just stay in my room and try to not get anybody mad at me. But he said, then that must mean that I'm aloof and grandiose. So that just proves. And the reporter said what was interesting is that I went to talk to the clinician who was seeing Tony. And the clinician told me, he said, yes, we accept that he faked madness to try to get out of a jail sentence. But he said, that just means he's cunning and manipulative. And the fact that he's wearing a pinstripe suit speaks to the glibness and superficial charm that he has. And therefore, he's a psychopath. So the reporter was saying, you know, basically, in one way, you could look at all these things and you could say, well, they're all normal things. Or in another way, you can look and say, well, no, they're all indications. Just in case you're interested, I wrote down what the factors are on this psychopath test. That if you have a bunch of these factors, that you're a psychopath. So the factors are glibness or superficial charm, grandiose sense of self-worth, pathological lying, cunning and manipulative, lack of remorse or guilt, shallow affect, in other words, genuine emotion is short-lived and lived and egocentric, callousness, lack of empathy, and a failure to accept responsibility for own actions. Now, I can tell you right now that when I read this list, I had at least one person that I know popped into my head. So, anyways, the reporter went on to say, you know, that he had interviewed some other people, specifically some business people, and he had interviewed one particular business person surrounding this idea that good capitalists are most likely psychopaths. And so he had interviewed this guy who had brought down, you know, he was known as the axe or something, the axe slaughter or the chainsaw or something, because he would go in and like cut a third of the people from the roles of the employees. And I mean, just take an axe to companies to get them back to the place where they could turn a profit. And he started going down this list, and the guy was debating him on all these. Well, you got to have some of that. Well, you got to do this. Well, that's not that. That's this. And the reporter said, I realized that I was desperate to prove that this capitalist was actually a psychopath. I wanted him to be. And so I was fitting him in much the same way that the clinicians were fitting Tony in to these things. Eventually, Tony did go before a tribunal, and he wanted the reporter to come and talk, I guess, about, you know, his situations. He did. And lo and behold, they did let him go. And it's interesting because even after all that, you know, the reporter said he's kept tabs on him, and he saw that at one point that Tony had been thrown in jail for a month because of a fight. And he wasn't sure what to think about that, but then he thought, well, but it was only for a month. It was only for a month. But then a little later, Tony had actually, you know, given him a call and said, hey, I'd like to take you out for a drink because you've done so much for me and I really appreciate what you've done. And he said, I didn't go. Because it's so hard to tell. And in his conclusion was that Tony was kind of in that gray area. That there were certainly some things about him that weren't quite wired right. Like he, after he got out, he told the reporter that he was going to go somewhere to Austria or something because there was a woman that was corresponding with him there that he had met. And he said, but she's married, so I'm going to have to go over there and break up her marriage. Okay, well, that's not... That's not a normal approach to life. But he said Tony's kind of in this gray area. But what's so fascinating to me about this whole thing is how much our preconceptions will influence how we interpret the behaviors of others. And there might be some good stuff to that in that it might keep us protected when it needs to, but I think it also then might mean that we are jumping to absolutely the wrong conclusions, that if we just back up and go, wait, slow down. And so I guess for me, this was really kind of a caution to not jump to conclusions too quickly about any individual person. I love having a matrix of information that I can process input through, and that can help me how I relate to another person. I love having that. And I've used that to very, very good effect in my life and in my work as a consultant. Because I pride myself on being able to walk into any situation, talk to someone for 3-4 minutes, get on their wavelength, figure out how they define themselves, and actually be able to have a real communication exchange with them and have them either as a friend share with me or as a business associate communicate to me the things that they would like to see occur. And I've had many very nice compliments from the people I work with along the lines, the things we like about you is that you understand when we are talking, you listen to us, and you actually get what we're saying. And then it goes and it works like you said it was going to work. And part of that is directly related to the fact that I have this matrix of information, and when I meet new people, I put it through that matrix and I say, okay, this is how I can relate to this person to really communicate well. So I really love having that. But this kind of a story really is a sobering story to exercise caution, to not completely jump and try to put people in boxes so quickly that you miss the diversity that there is. And so I've just kind of taken this as a lesson to myself to, if someone actually fits in the matrix, fine. You know, if that matrix is not quite a good fit, to make some adjustments and just, you know, understand that it's very, very easy to decide what you're going to believe and then just sort of start applying everything to that belief, whether the facts actually fit or not. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.